Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2015. Lecture 25, delivered on April 21, 2015. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 2.
Today, review for Exam 2. The structure of Exam 2 is identical to the structure of Exam 1. Part 1 is multiple choice, Part 2 is workout questions, and Part 3 is short essay answers. The Part 1, as you saw from the last exam, and I've told you this before, it's not the easiest because the questions can be random, and I'll give you some insights into what kinds of questions I'll be asking. And then Part 2, to be honest with you, it seems to me that the math in this exam is not as robust as the math in the first exam. There's more math, but it's easy, generally speaking, easy math. And I will, right after, about 6 o'clock, you'll have a narrative go up. I won't tell you what the problem is, but I will be describing, and it will be pretty obvious what you probably should do. And I would strongly encourage you to do the problem in the next 2 days before the exam so that you're not sweating it out and trying to get this done during the exam. It'll be quite easy for you to get it done if you just start early and often on it. And then Part 3, we'll talk about possible questions that I could ask you or problems for that part. And I'm going to go through my shtick, and then I'm going to open it up for you to ask me questions that you might have on this. So let me start here. Well, maybe I'll just put the exam up on the overhead so you can see it. No, you don't even fall for that anymore. The heck with you. Okay, look, a couple of things. As far as Part 1 goes, there's some math types of questions that are good to just put on the multiple choice. So I will ask you to find an optimal average target cash balance. Remember that lecture, the Miller-Orr formula, the cube root formula? That's a multiple choice kind of question. It's just kind of a no-brainer. However, I will give you answers that you would get if you apply the formula incorrectly. Okay? I'm that way. So just be sure that you have the formula available and that you apply it correctly math-wise. Okay, that's kind of a no-brainer. Another math question that I could probably ask you, I'll probably get put on there on the multiple choice part, a net present value question. I'll give you an initial cash outflow and the cash inflows over a period of years and a salvage value and a discount rate, and have you find for me the net present value. And then the question following, I'll have you find the internal rate of return. And always remember, salvage value you add to the last year's cash flow. Just don't forget that. I'll repeat that until finally everyone does it right. And of course, again, I will make sure that I have answers on this that are what would happen, what you get if you do it wrong. But this is just a calculator exercise. It's not very, it doesn't require higher thinking skills necessarily, so it's appropriate for a multiple choice kind of question. I'm going to ask you a question about degrees of operating, degrees of financial, and degrees of combined leverage on the multiple choice. I'll give you some possible DOL, DFL, DCL combinations and ask you, well, which one could possibly actually happen? And you should think about, well, what am I looking for there? I'll have you find me No, I won't. Oh, I asked that, God. Wow, that's off. Oh, anyway, let's go on to some other things. Now, I'm going to ask you some questions about securities regulation as far as forms that you would file for different corporate activities. And remember, I've brought up different forms, 10Q, 10K, 8K. I even mentioned a 14 at one point, Form 14, Form 10. I'll ask you a couple of different ways about that. And I'll ask you for some answers based on terminology. Tombstone, red herring, prospectus. Restricted stock. So make sure you have those terms down. You know what each one means. What do I mean by a selling document? What do I mean by a registration statement? What do I mean by a Form S-1 or a Form 8K? Just make a list of each of the terms that I brought up there in your notes and in the podcast, and just make sure that you have down what each of them means. And that'll take you a long way, because I asked probably about easily 5 questions on that. Now, I'm going to ask you some questions about securities. Make sure you know what common stock is, preferred stock. What's a warrant? There are 2 flavors of warrants, detachable and non-detachable warrants. You need to know those. You need to understand that concept. In bonds, you need to know terms like what's a senior bond? What do I mean by a debenture? Woman, what's a debenture? Study. Madam? Unsecured. An unsecured debt instrument, a bond. Yeah, there can be notes that are debentures too. You know, it doesn't, the length of it isn't so much, but you're right. It's an unsecured debt instrument, debentures are. Debentures. Tures. Debentures. Debenture. Debentures. Debentures, and then of course, the difference between a subordinated, senior, subordinated. I brought up some other kinds of things too, like callable, convertible, puttable. I even brought up cereal bonds. My favorite are cornflakes. Just know those terms. Sinking funds. Sinking funds. Oh, make sure also, you know, some of the, back in the securities law, securities regulations, the difference between the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934.
Can you say that again, sir?
Know the difference between what the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 deal with. You, sir, are a trader. You work for a big brokerage house. Which of those 2 laws is much more relevant to what you do? What's the name of the law? of?
1964. Oh, 34. Oh, my bad. I thought you said.
Yeah.
My bad. Sorry.
You stay out of finance, dude. Yeah, because it deals in secondary markets more. The Securities Exchange Act has more to do with primary market activities. But also, no, the Regulation D's. The Reg D's 504, 505, 506. And the differences, and also the Reg A. Yeah, that movie, that music from the islands, you know, Reg A, Bob Marley. Regulation A. No one ever appreciates good finance humor. The hell with it. Where was I before I tried to be funny and it didn't work? What about them? No, I was talking about Reg D 504, 505, 506, and Reg A. And one of those actually creates freely tradable stock, theoretically. Which one is it? Study. Okay, you are using a selling document pursuant to a Form S-1 registration for an IPO. Okay. What do you call that selling document?
I don't know.
Okay. You've drunk, it's the first letter.
Okay.
Yes. Raw.
Product.
I'm going to move away before I hurt the woman. What's the selling document you're going to use?
Igor, I need a brain. Go. No.
Oh, we got a Form S-1 registration statement has been filed. The quiet period is over. You are now going to sell the stock of this initial public offering. What is the selling document that you will use? What is it called?
I'm phoning a friend. He knows.
Prospectus?
I love it when you talk like that. My God, you're a great... You're muscular, too. No, anyway... yeah, prospectus. Okay, now... You're going to do a Reg D 504, which can generate freely tradable stock. What is the selling document that you are going to use in reliance upon the exemption from registration in a Reg D 504 offering?
Red herring?
Nope. That was on the other woman.
Tombstone.
Oh, no.
No.
A tombstone is never a selling document. If you try to use a tombstone to sell anything, you will become the bunkmate of Large Marge at a federal facility. You don't want that. She takes care of her girls. What are you going to use? Two words.
Red herring?
No. Okay. That's why we're doing this, by the way, is I got to tighten it. This happens every time. I'm acting like you're idiots. No. Everyone has a hard time. Look, a red herring is a prospectus that has red lettering because you can't actually use it to sell, but you can show it around. But it's sort of like the pre-publication prospectus. During the period before the actual you're allowed to sell the stock, you're allowed to show around this prospectus, but it has to have red lettering on it because it's not allowed to actually be used to sell yet. You're not in your selling period. And they call it a red herring just because of that red lettering on it. Now, once the red comes off it, it's a full-blown prospectus. That is your selling document. That should be your only selling document. Even though there's the tombstone, which announces the offering, even though there might be other kinds of literature or talk about the selling of the selling the stock, the only legal selling document is the prospectus. And that's the prospectus, not the red herring, which is a prospectus with red lettering on it that you can show around, but you can't actually sell stock with it. Now, there's an exemption from registration. There are a bunch of exemptions. You can sell stock without registering the stock. In general, selling stock this way creates Rule 144 restricted stock. It is unregistered. There is one of those exemptions which does create freely tradable stock. It's the $1 million offering called the Reg D 504. Now, Reg D 504 is like an offering. There's only one document that is a legal, legitimate selling document. It's not called a prospectus, though. Does anyone know what it's called? Just out of curiosity, do you remember what I said? It's called an offering circular. I wrote more offering circulars than prospectuses in my time because these were small companies. You can raise up to $1 million without registering the stock formally. Now, most states are going to require that you fill out forms for to sell in their states, but you don't have to go through the nightmare process of a full-blown Form S-1 or SB-1 or SB-2 registration. So know that. Just make sure that you know those kinds of things like that. Make sure you know that some of the terms like with respect to project evaluation. You can decide whether to go or no-go with a project a number of different ways. Some of them are more legitimate than others. Remember, what was one of the ways that is old school, but doesn't have any legitimacy, but it's still even used to this day once in a while by some older companies and older analysts? Does anyone remember that one way you can evaluate whether a project is a go or a no-go that I talked about? What was it? The payback method. Remember, you say, oh, well, any project that doesn't generate the enough money to cover the initial cost within so and so many years, well, we'll reject it. That's the old payback method. The main problem with it is it doesn't take into account the time value of money. Money in the future isn't worth money now. The second problem is you're just pulling your payback time out of your butt. Okay, then there were some ways that were more legitimate. What was one way that projects can be evaluated? Do you remember that? NPV. Classic, always in good taste. Another one? NPV, net present value approach. What's another one? Internal rate of return. Always write out your answers for me. Don't say NPV and IRR on an exam, because I'm expecting you to be able to communicate with an educated audience that might not know the terminology of finance. So write out, don't write IRR or NPV. Write out the words for me if it's an essay type of question. What's another way? We've got the illegitimate payback method. We've got NPV, which is solid. We've got internal rate of return. What else is there? Any others? There are a couple of others. What? Some of the deviation of variance. Oh, okay. And marginal cost of capital. Remember, we did the first way we actually looked at projects was through the marginal cost of capital approach, which is actually good and legitimate. But you notice that was kind of an odd thing, because the MCC approach is wildly different from NPV and IRR approaches. There was another one, too, I brought up. It's sort of a side stream off one of them. And it does suffer from that, well, you're pulling your number out of your butt for it. But it's still, what was it? Bingo! The hurdle rate method. Remember I told you there are some companies, well, the hurdle rate, if not, this project, if the internal rate of return of this project isn't more than the hurdle rate, we reject it. So it actually uses the internal rate of return, but it uses this thing that kind of just pulls you out of your butt, your hurdle rate. Well, our hurdle rate has been 12% for years. Any project with an internal rate of return of less than that 12%, we reject right off the bat. Okay, cool, whatever. The hurdle rate's another method. So there are five right there different project evaluation techniques. Three of them are strong, although I don't think I mentioned that there's a flaw in internal rate of return. It's a mathematical phenomenon. The internal rate of return, remember, it's supposed to, the NPV goes down, hits the IRR, and then goes through the IRR is where the NPV equals zero. If a project has more than one switch in the sign of the cash flows, in other words, negative to positive is one switch. But if a project goes negative to positive, then negative to positive, IRR is invalid. Because what will happen is mathematically the internal rate of return function will do that. Essentially a third degree polynomial or larger than that. So you've got to be careful. IRR, if your cash flow switches sign more than once, you have to do NPV. IRR is completely, it's just analytically invalid. Just by math, it is. So do watch that if you ever run into this in the real world. That's a flaw in the IRR model. And realistically, there are projects. Well, we start out putting money in. We make money for a few years. Then we have to put a lot of more money in. And then we make more money for a few more years. In a case like that, you couldn't use IRR to project evaluate. You would have to use NPV or MCC. Now, obviously, this is not going to be a complete, but... see if there's anything else that I... make sure you know the formulas for the component costs of capital. And make sure you know how fixed costs and variable costs contribute to volatility down the income statement. Again, make sure that you know how fixed costs and variable costs contribute to volatility as you go down the income statement. That's very good tapping. Oh, ouch. Okay. Part two. Obviously, I'm going to put up a narrative for you. And it'll just be a blinking red light, which kind of problem it is. And as always, I telegraph my punches. I'm not going to mess with you. Oh, dear God. Boy, that's going to be confusing when you see that on the exam. How did that happen? There's a printing error. Well, I'll have to explain that to you when I hand it out. It's kind of obvious. I'm going to have you look at 2 years comparative financial income statements and calculate the degree of operating leverage, the degree of financial leverage, and the degree of combined leverage. And then I'm going to ask you, yes. Okay, I'm going to give you the income statements of a company for two consecutive years. And then I'm going to have you calculate the degree of operating leverage, the degree of financial leverage, and the degree of combined leverage. Remember those three formulas. They're no-brainer formulas, but you can make a mistake along the way. Just don't. And then I'm going to ask you, what was the dominant contributing factor in the degree of combined leverage? In other words, you're going to calculate DOL, DFL, and DCL, And then I'm going to ask you, what was causing DCL to be as large as it was? Now, here's what you don't answer. You're going to see three numbers. Two of the numbers multiply together to be the third number, DCL. DOL times DFL is DCL. In part D, I'm going to say, what was causing DCL to be so large? The thing you don't answer is, well, it was DOL, or well, it was DFL. That's not what I'm looking for. In other words, you've got two for DOL, three for DFL, and so DCL is going to be six. And I say, what caused DCL to be six? And you say, well, what was the most significant thing that caused DCL to be six? And you say, well, it was DFL. That I could get a third grader to say that. What I'm looking for is for you to tell me what cost was causing this to happen. So if I saw that 2 times 3 made 6, and what DOL was 2, DFL was 3, and DCL was 6, and I say, what was the major contributing factor to the size of DCL? What would you say? Which number was bigger, 2 or 3?
Three.
We're going to turn you into a financial analyst right away, aren't we, ma'am? Okay, 3. Okay, what was the 3? Was that DOL or DFL?
DFL.
Okay, what is DFL measuring? What kind of volatility? Okay, say that first thing. Financial? Financial?
Leverage?
No.
Okay.
Financial? Call. Help me. What is DFL measuring? What kind of... is volatility increased by variable costs?
No.
Is volatility increased by fixed costs?
Yes.
And degree of financial leverage measures what kind of fixed costs? Good. Fixed interest costs is what is causing the DCL6 to be so large. If DOL is 2, DFL is 3, so that means DCL is 6, then it was DFL that was creating the most magnification. DFL is degree of financial leverage, which measures volatility from financing. What is causing the financial leverage to be so large? Fixed interest cost. That's what it measures. I'll let that go and let that soak in. And I'm also going to ask you a marginal cost of capital question. Now, if you were a betting kind of person, what do you suppose that narrative that you'll see in a while is about? What do you suppose it's about? Now, let's get down to a more basic level. I'm going to ask you a marginal cost of capital question on the exam. I'm going to post a narrative tonight that describes that's one of the problems. Which problem do you suppose it's going to be? I want you to say marginal cost of capital. You are an intellectual colossus. Yes. I mean, it's like a blinking red light. The MCC problems, you know, they have this very formal structure. You know, this company is considering these projects, and these are the financing costs, and this is the cost of the stock. It follows very closely the pattern you've seen on the example, and the examples I've shown you up to this point. It's the same structure of the problem, just monkey see, monkey do. But you gotta be really careful when you draw that MCC graph and that IOS graph, because I'll tell you right now, this one comes in tight. Somewhere in there, it comes in really close. And so you've got to do the graph really carefully with straight edge and all that, no drinking beforehand, so that you can see it, so that you can catch it. Because you'll have time to be able to do it very well. I actually saw some kid who managed to figure out how to make his TI-83 calculator do the MCC and iOS graphs, and then he could zoom in and see exactly where it was. That was kind of weird, impressive. Anyway, okay, here we go. Essay questions. Yeah. Huh?
The last thing you said,
yeah. There are not that many. Not that many on this. But, of course, that means there's more bang on each one, of course. And that's kind of a nasty thing. Oh, did I mention there will be a break-even analysis question? I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that.
On part two,
there will be a break-even. Yeah, I forgot. What? Yeah, those are different ones. Now we're going, I forgot to mention, yeah, there will be a break-even analysis. I forgot to look at the first page. A break-even analysis. And then I'll also give you an NPV problem and an IRR problem. Part two, you'll have a break-even. Those are really easy to do. Just identify the parts of the formula. And then the NPV IRR, that's just a calculator question. Just a calculator question is all. Be careful about rounding. Just, I want to warn you about rounding. Be careful about it. Now, remember my rule. When you do a break-even, I want to mention this. When you do a break-even analysis, you're going to come out with a break-even output level. Remember what I told you to write down. When you get your answer on your calculator, if you write down the wrong answer, if you don't follow the rule that I gave you, you lose a point. Because you gave me the answer, but you gave it to me one less than what it was supposed to be. Okay? Remember break-even analysis. If you get an answer like break-even is at 722.3, don't give me 722.3 because there's no such thing as 0.3 of a unit. And if you give me 722, you haven't broken even. So whenever you see a part of an output level, you always give me the break-even output level as the next number up. Remember I talked about that. Yeah.
There won't be a target
for the part two. No, that's in part one. It's such a formulaic thing. I mean, yeah, and God, watch out. I was just kind of curious about target cash balance. If you just did a search on the internet for target cash balance, now they bring up a couple of different formulas. And I told you that the one I showed you was called the Miller-Orr formula. It's very popular. I found easily, probably 6 websites that gave the Miller-Orr formula wrong, including Wikistupedia. I actually went against my usual and made a comment on that one. But watch it. Use what I gave you in class, what's in your textbook for the Miller-Orr optimal target cash balance. Anyway, essay questions. Why would a company issue equity to pay off debt if equity is more expensive than debt? Remember we said equity is more expensive than debt. Why would a company do an offering of common stock declaring we're issuing this stock so that we can call in some of our old bonds? Why would it do that? Again, why would a company issue equity to pay off debt? Since equity is more expensive than debt, why would a company do a public offering of stock to call in some old bonds. What is the relationship between net present value and internal rate of return? Give three ways a company can do project evaluation. What is meant by optimal capital structure? What is meant by optimal capital structure? A company that has restricted stock can go public with that stock. How? Again, a company that has, it's privately held. It has common stock, but it's restricted stock. It was never registered. How could that company go public with that stock? Why would a company issue serial bonds? Most of your debt obligations are puttable. Explain. Most of your debt obligations are puttable. Explain. Give three reasons a company would issue dividends. Give three reasons a company would issue dividends. Now, let me look back here at something. I can't believe I forgot to put one that was on. It was suddenly occurring to me, oh, there's one in the part two that I have to tell you that's on there. And I'm looking. I forgot to put it on there. Oh, gee. Okay, so you won't have to worry about that, but you will on the final. Did I leave that one off?
Yeah,
well, spank me hard and call me Cupcake. Okay, I forgot. The points add up, so apparently I just left it off there. Okay, your turn. Questions for me. Oh, it was. I'll even tell you which one I left off. It was one where I. It was like on that quiz where I gave you. There are these senior subordinate, junior, and this is the liquidated value. Here's the hard assets, or more. Which who gets what? I left it off there. I know, right? You know, but then again, I am known as Easy Al. But so help me God if you ever say that to me. Hey, yes, ma'am.
How come if the price of stock goes up, then shareholders are cheaper?
Huh?
How come when the price of stock goes up,
then
the shareholders become...
Oh, the cost of the commodity cost of equity goes down? Okay, here's how it works. In other words, you see that formula, D1 over P plus G. So that's the component cost of capital. And if P goes up, the actual component cost of capital called equity goes down. Here's why. Okay, now, I want you to imagine two different families. And you were actually in each of these families. Your first family was on the prairie back in the 1800s. Now, you died and you were reincarnated, and now you're in a modern family. Okay, now on the prairie, Dad and Mom had 12 kids. Okay? Now, when you were reborn, how many kids did Mom and Dad have in your family? Two. Okay, so now, who's going to cost me more as a family to feed? Bingo. Who's going to cost me less to feed? And paradoxically, when I've got 12 kids, you know, if one of them gets eaten by a bear, I'm not really, I'm sad, especially if the kid worked hard in the fields. But, I mean, it's not the end of the world, and I still expect dinner on the table that night. You know, if there's anything left for the kid, maybe they can boil it up. But the thing, though, is that paradoxically, at the same time, you are less expensive. For me as a company, a few shareholders at a high value each are a cheaper thing for me to manage. Because when I want to bring in another person, you want to be in my family now? Okay, if she's $50 a share, you have to give me $50 to join my family. But on the prairie, you know, supply was larger, price was lower, so I'm not going to get as much out of you. If I can't ask you for as much, maybe $8. So you get the idea that if I need, now with few of you, you're quite valuable, so bringing in another one's going to bring me a lot of money. But when there's 12 of you, you can't ask for much. So it's not going to be worth much for me to bring you in. So your cost of coming in is going to be greater. The cost of all of you is going to be greater. And so in the end, I want my share prices to go up. That's why, you know, I have companies that told me in the day, well, once we sell the stock, why would we care about the price of it? After we've sold it, we've got them. Well, you do in a way, but that comes back to bite you in the ass over time. If you don't keep wanting to push that price of that stock up, then you actually have an incredibly high component cost of capital in the equity. And if you ever go out there again and ask the markets to buy more common stock from you, they're going to say, really? This is what you did for those shareholders that were existing? You never pushed the stock price above $6 a share? Well, fine. We'll give you $5 a share. See how you like that. So that's why, even if you're not going to sell any more common stock, as the corporate officers and directors, you want to keep that stock price as high as you can, simply because that makes your component cost of capital lower, D1 over P plus G. Did that answer your question at all? Okay. You were looking a little confused there about the prairie thing and all that. And you looked a little offended about the bear eating the kid. The kid wasn't that great anyway. Kind of slow. He got kicked by he wasn't half slow. I'd say he was more half-assed. Half. D1 over P plus G. That's the cost of existing equity.
D1 over P plus G.
Yeah, D1 over P. And all of that plus G, that's your component cost of capital called existing equity. Now D1 over the quantity P minus F, all of that plus G, that's the cost of new equity, which is worse. But in either case, the lower your price of your stock is, the more costly that sucker becomes. So that's why you want to keep your stock price as high as you can so that that component cost of capital is as low as possible. That means, by the way, that you'll be able to take on more projects because your marginal cost of capital tiers will be lower because your component cost of capital and the equity were lower. What else? Yeah.
How do you have to
feel like the modern let me look real quick. I thought I asked one question about it. It's a multiple choice kind of question if I did. I'll hit you a little harder with that one on the final, but Was that a dog being kicked? I heard it. Hey!
I thought I did here, but maybe I didn't. I think I've written the final, and I'm getting a little bit blurred between what I did on the final. No, I don't think I did on this one. It's on the final. Oh yeah, I did.
I did ask one on. I describe a configuration of current assets against current liabilities, and I say, which approach would this be, conservative, moderate, or aggressive? It's on the it's in the multiple choice. I mean, when you get into the ones where you're actually looking at numbers, that can be, unless it's moderate, is it moderate or conservative? One of them is very clear. The other ones are pretty darn fuzzy. So, I'd be glad I didn't do that. Other questions? Yeah. There is a level of current assets below which you never see the company go. That would be your permanent current assets. But you will see it go above that value on a cyclical basis. Those are the temporary current assets. So, for example, with my company, I was curious, so I just did the calculation again. I was looking at my running current asset balance in my own company. And I see on a trend line over the last 4 years, there has been this trend line of always there that started about $500, and it's now up to like about $12,000. And it's on the straight trend line. But you see the number float above this on a monthly basis. Sometimes it's up here, and then in the summer season, it starts to fall back down toward that trend line. That stuff that's up there part of the year, that's the temporary current assets. Now, that doesn't mean it's the same inventory that's causing the permanent current asset, but that seems to always be the number that's holding there. Like I said, it's on a trend line. It's not a flat line, but there's this trend line that's always there. And then it floats above that in the fall, late fall in the winter, and then just after this show that I just did. Sure enough, that blob that's above the trend line trickle down a little bit. Then the show's in May and June, it'll trickle down more. And then by the time I get to the end of the season, at the end of September, it'll be back down on that trend line again. But right now, it's way up there like a blob. And then I saw it trickle down. I haven't done the full numbers yet, but it definitely just eased off. Go.
Okay, so looking at the balance sheet, can we just slide out and say that like cash is temporary?
You can't do that. You can't, because there is some companies always want to have a cash balance. Remember that target cash balance? They're going to want to have a wad of cash that is going to always be there. But sometimes the cash will go above that, and sometimes it'll go below, come back down. If you ever, you know what petty cash is, right? Okay, a petty cash drawer is the money that you have, just the actual cash money you can pull out for pizzas or to pay some delivery boy for something or other. Now, that petty cash balance, when I was running school in Columbus, a junior school in Columbus, Ohio, junior college in Columbus, Ohio, we had a petty cash drawer. Now, I wanted there to always be at least $50 in there. Okay, now sometimes there'd be more because kids would come in and they'd pay some late fees or something like that. So it would build up and then I'd skim some off and put it. There were things I needed. I mean, companionship at night? God! What are you, a slave driver? Jeez. Do you know how much Jack Daniels? But anyway, so yeah, there would be like a block of cash, but then, so you can't say all cash is temporary, all cash is permanent. Same with inventory. Not all inventory is permanent, not all is accounts receivable. Now, sometimes you'll have a ton of receivables, but I really wouldn't want receivables to fall ever to zero. I'd have a target like, well, I want $2,000 in receivables on average at any given time. Sometimes it'll be well above that. Sometimes it'll be a little below that, but I will want kind of like a permanent part that'll always be there. I always have some people who owe me money. I want that. And then sometimes I'll have more people owe me money. And a few times, maybe some people. So if it falls below that, I'll ease my terms so that more people can get things on credit.
So on the exam, are you going to say, like, okay, 30% is permanent, or 20% of the cash is...
I wouldn't do it that complicated. I would never do it that complicated. I mean, good heavens, if I got into real life, you'd slash my tires. I just bought two new tires, $40 each sale at Walmart. I don't want you slashing those. Those are worthwhile. Anything else? Yeah.
Is there any
Yeah, well, that one question on different dividend policies. And obviously, also in the marginal cost of capital problem, you'll have to know about dividends. And make sure it's always the dividend one period out, not the current dividend. That just frosts the lease on my boxers when people do everything right, but they forget that you use D1, not D0. What else? Yeah.
Is there anything
about targeting? Yeah, that multiple choice question. There will be a multiple choice question. I mean, it's such a, like, it's just apply the formula kind of thing. So have any of you ever heard of Bloom's taxonomy of learning? There are these different levels of learning, from basic kinds of things on up through deep cognitive skills. Multiple choice tests and questions are for basic kinds of just monkey see, monkey do. Essay questions, project types of things are for higher learning. Since this Miller-Orr formula is such a basic thing, it's appropriate for a multiple choice question, really. So that's why it's just going to be. But of course, I give you all the wrong answers you would get if you apply the formula wrong. Yeah. Yes, always. 4x6, both sides. Anything else? Yeah. Okay. Do you know who John Wayne Gacy was? Yes. He would lure young men to his house, and then he would torture them and kill them and cut them up and put them in his refrigerator. Okay, now, he didn't do all of them in one mass killing. He did them over time. What do you call the kind of murderer who kills people over a period of time? A serial killer, okay? So, a serial bond. Suppose that I am a bond holder, and these people would like to, all of us, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us would like to lend you money. You need $5 million. Okay, now, our concern is that if we lend you all $5 million at the same time, in 10 years when you owe it back to us, you would have to pay $5 million in one shot, okay? That would be murder for you. So what we'll do is, I will lend you $1 million for 10 years. A year later, he will lend you $1 million for 10 years. A year later, he will lend you $1 million for 10 years. A year later, he will lend you $1 million for 10 years. And finally, he will lend you a year later $1 million for 10 years. So in other words, the date of the lending is staggered and the time of maturity is staggered. Both. So that means that you don't have to pay off, you don't have to kill all 5 of the $1 million bonds at once. You kill $1 million off every year after 10 years. Do you follow how that will make it more likely that you will not be unduly burdened by the payoff? That is a serial bond. Okay? You got the idea?
Yeah.
Okay. It's another way. Sinking funds are one way we can do it. We lend you $5 million and you have to put money in the bank every month so that we make sure you have $5 million when we're all paid off. That's one way to ensure that you have the money to pay us off. The serial bond is another way we can ensure that you have the money to pay all of us off. You follow it?
Yeah.
Okay. And don't let any really weird guys invite you over to their place. Seriously. Okay? Real finance for real people. What else? Anything else? Yeah, that's all I have for you. Go home.